That's the great 6'7" Brooklyn-born and raised and educated Jamaican parentage of Jamaican parentage jazz legend Randy Weston with Marrakesh Blues, originally recorded in 1972. Randy Weston is a highly esteemed world ambassador of jazz. He lived in Morocco from 1967 to 72. Is in his 80s now and still going strong, still living in Brooklyn, a real Brooklyn guy. Well, of course, that's him on piano with Henry Teshier on bass and Azzedine Miles, Niles Weston, and Rebop Kweku Ba, both on percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, August the 5th, and two things we'll be talking about today. In the second half of our program, we'll be talking about international law and impediments to peace in Palestine. But first, I wanted to just bring you up to snuff, just to keep adding to this primer that you ought to be keeping handy on the Eric Garner case. As you know, Eric Garner was killed on July the 17th as a result of a chokehold placed on him by police who were arresting him for selling, as they call them, Lucy, or just individual cigarettes on the street. His death officially was ruled a homicide. The medical examiner of the city of New York announced that on last Friday, saying that the death is officially a homicide as a result of a chokehold placed on Garner. And of course, we know that the case has brought again attention to the ways that police operate in communities of color. Garner was from Staten Island, and in that area of Staten Island, it's a climate, a very pro-police climate out there, so there are concerns about whether this case is going to be objectively prosecuted. Well, I want to bring some attention to where the case is going, and the reason is I'm seeing some signs that are already disturbing, and this case is going down an all too familiar path, and I just want it on the record so you know that these things are happening. It would seem that, you know, well, Reverend Al Sharpton is playing a pivotal role now in basically chaperoning this case and calling for a thorough investigation, calling for justice, and in his words, justice would mean now Most recently, he's asked that the federal government intervene. And this is what gives me the clue that this case is already on the wrong course. Now, that would sound a little bizarre to say that asking for the federal government to be involved is an indication that the case is on the wrong course. It actually, to me, it is, because I've covered these cases so many times, and we see the same pattern evolving. What has happened so far in terms of the public awareness of it and the agitation around this case, and there ought to be agitation about this case, basically it has so far made an excellent case for the attorney involved, and that is Sanford Rubinstein, because now it is almost a done deal that this case will result in a very fat payout by the city for the wrongful death of Eric Garner. So there's no question about that. And I had talked earlier before when we had Alton Maddox on, and Alton Maddox, I asked him, did it bother him that we see Sanford Rubinstein again appearing in this case as the attorney? Because so many cases in which Alfred Sharpton has been involved also involved Sanford Rubinstein, and there was some discomfort about that. And it is not because, well, he is, you know, he basically has the case, and it would be yet another case of a major wrong committed against a person of color in the city of New York, in which we've seen a fat payout, in which we see Sanford Rubinstein coming in on the tide of a huge public outcry and groundswell, and benefiting, in effect, from that. To get the maximum payout. Okay, I get that. But what is problematic is that it seems as if that's already where the case is stopping. The case is stopping at the fact that this will result in a predictably large payout. And that is not, as Alton Maddox had said, and I agreed with that, that is not what this case ought to do. This case ought to serve as a benchmark for dramatic changes in not just the way police operate. And this, you know, I get very upset about the fact that people die. People have to die. And then you get this silly response, oh, well, we will revisit our training techniques. No. Why do people have to die? And they always are. People of color have to die before there's a change in the training techniques. And in any event, the chokehold was banned since 1993. I pointed out to you before that under the 48-hour rule, which was a union provision, they got this agreed to as part of a contract, a bargaining unit contract. But it really is a privilege that is accorded any police officer who is in a situation where he or she is likely to be investigated on a criminal level, that they can invoke the 48-hour rule, which allows them legally to resist any kind of questioning for 48 hours or two working days, whichever works to the officer's advantage. Clearly that happened here. Because even as we speak, there has been no discussion about charges already formulated against the police officers involved. So they have invoked that privilege, and in effect, that amounts to temporary immunity from prosecution. That's my position about that. No ordinary citizen enjoys the privilege of telling anybody who appears to question them, well, I'm not going to be able to talk to you until next Tuesday at 3:00. We don't have that privilege as citizens, but police officers automatically do. And so they take advantage of that. And I've known this to be the case in so many cases where, with the invocation of the 48-hour rule, you find that witnesses are located and sometimes intimidated. People even disappear. They just vanish into thin air. They move out of town. They're not available. You have evidence being tampered with. You have instances in which people are intimidated into what to say. People are told to lie. Officers cook up among themselves what the story is going to be in terms of their defense. In that 48 hours, you find that the attorneys for the officers usually contact the medical examiner's office, and they know before it's even publicly announced what the deal is. What is the evidence going to be looking like when it is officially announced? So they know from the very beginning, from the inside, they have an inside track on how to prepare a defense. It's happening in this case already. We find that today, for example, the police union is going to be having a news conference, and they're going to be talking about the fact that there's been a rush to judgment here, and the officers are to be given the benefit of the doubt, even though, of course, we saw this whole horrible event unfold on video, caught by the cell cameras of witnesses to this awful incident. But they're telling us that there's something else, that what we are seeing, we cannot trust our eyes. Our eyes are deceiving us. And there's a whole other explanation, which means that the U.S., the police union has already begun to take its role in the apparatus of defense of the officers. All right, let's just remind everyone. In this scenario, the victim is an African-American man and the officers involved are white. The police officer in particular who applied the chokehold, Daniel Pantaleo, was placed on desk duty and relieved of his badge and gun in the meantime, and so far has been able to carry on his life. You know, he's supposedly traumatized by the event, but he's been able to carry on life, go home, have a meal, you know, and proceed with life just the same. So from July the 17th, today is August the 5th, we have no charges brought against any of the officers involved. They have not been subjected to the kind of questioning that ordinary citizens would be subjected to, and we know that the police department also has its so-called administrative proceedings, which means that before this case actually gets to the prosecutor, it will go through its permutations within the department itself. So we have this question of which law actually supersedes the other. Is it the people's law or the departmental ruling? Now, in the middle of all of the hubbub about the case, in the middle of all of the public stuff and the press conferences and the television cameras and the protests and all of this stuff, in the middle of all of that, nobody is watching this aspect of the case. And to call in to say, well, you know, I'm calling for federal investigation is a cop-out. And I'll tell you why. If the federal government were to be involved in this case, it would be on the civil rights violation level, and it would probably be after the case goes through its trial at state level in the first place. And this, the change that ought to occur with this case is that should stop. This case requires nothing less than the appointment of a special prosecutor. But I notice that Reverend Sharpton is not asking for that. A special prosecutor ought to be handling this case right now, because there are too many corrupting factors already at play. But to do that, you will have to bring pressure on the state's leading Democrat, Governor Cuomo. And you will have to insist that he appoint a special prosecutor. There has not been a very good history with his father on this count. When Mario Cuomo was governor of the state of New York, there were so many cases in which a special prosecutor had to be appointed, and had it not been literally for the legal tactic taken by Alton Maddox to force it to happen, it would never have happened, and there would never have been justice in a couple of these cases. So you have to have a special prosecutor in this case. That is absolutely necessary. Never mind whether this case is going to get a big payout and make Sanford Rubinstein a lot of money as a lawyer's fee. The question is about justice here, and it's going down the wrong path already. And we have to be mindful of that. This is where the difference is made. It is all well and good to talk about, you know, civil rights violations. This is not about civil rights violations. He's a dead man. And this was a criminal act. And we clearly see that not just one police officer was involved, but a whole group of them were involved. And a whole group of people and the medical technicians who were supposed to render aid and did not also are involved. And if anybody understands the history of Staten Island and the culture of Staten Island, to feel comfortable about the idea that the Staten Island District Attorney would be prosecuting this case vigorously with the intent of making sure that this police officer actually pays for his crime, you're dreaming if you think that's going to happen. The case is already being situated so that he is not to be charged with murder. The officer at best will be charged with some other form of manslaughter or some lesser charge, but it will not be murder. You see that the police already are intervening. The police union is having a news conference today. That means they are taking a very active role in diminishing if any charges at all will actually materialize, that there will be not the full force of the law exercised here, but that from the very beginning, the charge would be taken down several notches. It will not be murder. It will not be homicide, even though the medical examiner has declared it to be homicide. So we see the invocation of the 48-hour rule. We see that since July the 17th until now, the officers have not been under any form of detention. They've been placed on administrative duty, although clearly a homicide occurred here. Now that the ruling is official, made official on Friday, announced on Friday, well, how is this police officer still walking around? Already there should be vigorous prosecution going on, but we have a whole different system of justice, and it does not comfort anybody. It should not comfort anybody that there's this call for federal investigation. The federal government is not going to come in here. So that is a public a diversion, and that I find to be quite embarrassingly shameful, actually, to say, well, I'm calling for the federal government. I was the only reporter in the room, the only one allowed in the room, because a whole group of African chiefs insisted that I be there. When Reverend Sharpton and a bunch of other folks decided they were going to have a meeting with none other than Eric Holder to discuss the slaughter of Amadou Diallo. They didn't want me in the room. And the African chiefs who asked me to accompany them to Washington said, if she is not in the room, we're not having a discussion. It was about getting federal intervention in the Amadou Diallo case. What happened to that? Nothing. Nothing came of that. Eric Holder was then the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And the top guy. Nothing came of it. It was a ceremonial meeting. Nothing came of it. So when Sharpton again insists that we're going to have this federal investigation, that's what we want. No, this is totally within the purview of the city of New York to take charge of this case. The city council ought to be on this case like white on rice, demanding that there should be an inquiry before the city council right now. The city, the police commissioner ought to be called before the city council right now. But we have these folks ducking and diving everywhere, not wanting to take direct responsibility and exercise the power that they do have. Don't tell me you want a federal investigation. No. Make the local process work. That's your job. Make it work. Don't cop out and tell people, well, we asked for the feds to come in. The feds are not coming in. They didn't come in for Amadou Diallo. They're going to come in for Eric Garner. No, they're not. And this is not about civil rights violations. This is about cops killing a citizen. That's what this is about. So I see the case going down that track. And it could only mean that it will yield the predictable result. The charge will be some thing other than murder. And in the end, he will walk away. And all of the others, similarly, will walk away from culpability in the murder of the citizen. And we'll have all the television lights, and we'll have all of the drama unfolding, and you know, the fiery speeches and all of that. But one person already has obtained exactly what he desires out of this case, and that's Sanford Rubinstein. He's gotten a whole bunch of people to solidify his stake in this case. He's going to get a very nice percentage of a fat payout by the city. But who is insisting on the changes that ought to be made here with this case? Who is guarding the house? Who is guarding the integrity of this case? And who is seeing to the very unattractive, this is very unattractive work, of paying attention to the details that are important here? It's not about making all that noise. It's about having the tacticians, the legal tacticians who know what to do. Because what we will end up with is yet another wave of public outrage. And it essentially will just end up fizzling away. And the focus will then be, well, the city had to pay. And that's a good thing. The city had to pay. No, it's not. This is supposed to be a transformative moment. And people ought to be taking care of business. And the business to be taken care of here is making sure that all of the working parts of this drama do their job and deliver the result that is demanded here, and nothing less. That's the task. I want to bring this to people's attention so it is on the record. This is not a mystery, and this is not a very difficult thing, and this is not some highly complex situation. No, it isn't. It is never that complex when the roles are reversed. when citizens are held culpable for acts committed against other citizens and especially against police. We need to have this case deliver an entirely different result, and already it is going down the wrong path. I have said it, it's on the record. We will come back to this discussion because it will be necessary. But it is important to alert people that this case is already on the wrong path. I'll take this break and come back, and we'll talk about impediments to peace in Palestine. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today we learn, of course, that there has been a 72-hour truce declared in Gaza between Gaza and the Israeli forces. I should say between Hamas and Israeli forces with respect to Gaza. And people are hoping, there's hope that somehow this would lead to the ultimate prize, which is a rapprochement, some kind of a negotiated peace between Israel and Palestine. You know, I hate even saying those two words, because Palestine is Israel. You know, Israel is Palestine. But we know that this has been a major problem. And our guest today, by way of a speech that he made, is Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. He was appointed by the United Nations as a special rapporteur on Palestine. That is somebody who focuses on the specific problems and reports to the UN on these problems in Palestine. He's explaining in a speech that he made at the University of London why and how many attempts at negotiating a peace deliberately have been sabotaged, principally by Israel. And I thought it very important to provide this as a context for the next level of discussion that will soon arise. Today I'm doing a primer on things. I'm putting you ahead of the subjects, ahead of what's to come. Here in the speech, he explains very, very succinctly and in a very cogent way what the special impediments have been and who basically has been impeding any degree of a forward movement in not just in Israel / Palestine, but in the region. So here is Richard Falk. I'll come back to him after he's through.
Way of thinking, which I think is at the core of the conventional approach to the issue, the so-called two-state solution, two-state consensus, it's either hypocritical or internally incoherent. It's hypocritical if it is meant to disguise the degree to which what is being called peace has nothing to do with Palestinian self-determination. It's incoherent if it really proposes that you can both incorporate the settlements and the ethnic cleansing and still come out the other end with a viable and independent Palestine. And this this, I think, is very important to absorb, both in terms of context and historical evolution. Because one of the things that we're taught to forget several things about this encounter of these two national narratives. One of the things we're taught to forget is the relevance of international law, the relevance of Palestinian rights. Because if you look at all the issues that are supposedly to be negotiated, the rights of refugees, the access to water, the status of Jerusalem, the borders that should be become permanent, the status of the settlements. All of these issues, if you look at them from the perspective of international law and the legal rights of the two people, would be resolved on the in favor of the Palestinians. So one of the ways that Israel uses its disparities in hard power, reinforced by the diplomatic protection of the United States, is to exclude international law from the negotiating process. And any attempt to invoke the rights of refugees or the nature of Jerusalem is said to be a disruption of the peace process. And that represents a kind of approach to international negotiations which embodies this hard power realism, that what diplomacy is about is translating disparities of hard power into stable, permanent relationships. In this context, it means stabilizing a structures of injustice and legalizing criminal practices and policies. So it's a very serious, it's a very serious thing. The element of history, which is another perspective that we're taught basically to forget. The most important element, historically, is the extent to which this issue of the future of Israel, the nature of the conflict, has always been approached with an unabashedly colonialist outlook. Ever since the Balfour Declaration, decided in London here where Jews would have a homeland, it was a European decision without any effort at consulting the people affected by the decision. It was the characteristic of that time, that post-World War I period, and particularly in the region of the Middle East, where the colonial leadership, the colonial elites, felt they could do whatever they wanted and have that implemented politically through their hard power dominance. And what the last half century has dramatized and exemplified is both the decline of hard power dominance and the rise of soft power ascendancy. That's what the decolonization movement exemplified. Because in almost every case, the weaker side, from a military perspective or a hard power perspective, prevailed politically. And indeed, the Israel-Palestine situation is one of the last remnants. It's perhaps the last important remnant of the colonial era. And it's a remnant that, because it's so out of touch with history, with the historical development that discredited colonialism and then induced through struggle its collapse, it requires extra violence to sustain this ahistorical way of trying to translate hard power dominance into a stable political structure. And it's for that reason that the policies of Israel have moved more and more toward extreme measures and extreme approaches. And if one examines the retreat that the Palestinians have made over the course of their struggle with the Zionist project, one sees this in very tangible form. I mean, the Balfour Declaration promised the Jewish people a homeland in historic Palestine. The UN came along in 1947 and proposed a partition that gave the Palestinians 45% of the historic mandated former Ottoman province. And that 45%, again, that UN decision, which now seems like a dream from a Palestinian perspective to have that realized, but that UN decision was, again, something made in New York without any effort to consult the people that were affected by it. It was, again, a kind of colonialist way of solving a European problem. And it resulted in the so-called War of Independence that ended up with this Green Line, an expanded Israel, where the Palestinians were reduced to a territory of 22% of the historic Palestine. And it was an extraordinary and maybe ill-considered concession of the PLO back in 1988 to say, we will accept this 22% as the basis of a viable Palestinian state. And that 22% will satisfy our self-determination aspirations, and we will accept the existence of Israel. And now what we've seen is that that 22% has been diminished by another 38% through the settlement blocks, through the roads that have been built around the settlements, through the separation wall, and by the changes in the character of the city of Jerusalem. So now it's 14% that is at stake for the Palestinians. And what's important about this progression is the steady increase in the proportionate control over this contested land by the Israeli side, and the squeezing of the Palestinians more and more. And in that sense, also, one needs to take account of the fact that not only was the territory of Israel expanded, but the Palestinians that had lived in pre-67 Israel were forcibly expelled by and large. And the catastrophe for the Palestinian people, the so-called Nakba, involved both the loss of territory and the ethnic dispossession from their historic places of residence. So I think it's that we are witnessing then a dynamic that requires a recognition that the world of sovereign states and the United Nations have not been able to address this remnant of colonialism in a manner that produces either sustainable peace or justice or a implementation of international law, and that we've reached the point, given all that has happened over this period of 62 years, where the only outcomes that one can realistically envision at this stage is either a democratic, secular, unified state that respects the rights of all people living within its borders, or some kind of extension and intensification of the existing apartheid state. There are no other alternatives but some variant of a one-state solution, because a two-state solution presupposes the capacity to reverse all of these developments that have occurred over the last 43 years, which would almost certainly produce a civil war within Israel, among other things. At the same time, we understand that it looks impossible to achieve this goal, just as it looked impossible to get rid of apartheid in South Africa without a bloody war. And one of the things that I think is important in the solidarity movement and the struggle that it has, that it is engendering, is to understand that in history the impossible happens, and that the rational mind, which would induce one to pessimism about what is likely, what is feasible, often is, I think, unable to cope with the kind of historical changes that are not anticipated and that cannot be understood until after they've happened. Academic mind, particularly, is much better in retrospect than it is in prospect. It can always come and give you an explanation of why what happened did happen, but it very rarely can anticipate convincingly that which seems unpredictable. And so I think, in bringing my remarks to a close, that the future of the Palestinian struggle is much bound up with two developments. The first is a tactical shift from hard power resistance to reliance on the soft power instruments of nonviolent coercion. And that's why the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is so historically critical and relevant, because that's the way to mobilize a consciousness both within Israel, within the United States, within Europe, that can change the climate in such a way that what does now seem impossible becomes a real policy alternative. And the other aspect of this phase of struggle is to recognize that it's no longer a territorial conflict. The symbolic battlefield is global, and that was also characteristic of the anti-apartheid campaign. And in that sense, the United Nations role as the arbiter of legitimacy in seeking a policy outcome is very important. It's one of the battlefields, so to speak, where legitimacy wars are won and lost. And it is, in this sense, the movement of people in support of this struggle has a great relevance. And I think in that sense, what Michael Mansfield referred to as the importance of the universal jurisdiction debate that's going on in this country comes into play. Because what universal jurisdiction does is to say that we're living in an international society with very weak international institutions to uphold global norms, and that those global norms, if they are to be implemented, have to rely on national legal and especially judicial institutions. And the great thing about the notion of accountability that was imposed on surviving German and Japanese leaders after World War II was the sense that even though that was victor's justice, the promise was made at Nuremberg, particularly by the American prosecutor, Justice Jackson, that this kind of law will only be respected in the future if it's applied by the victors to their own actions, to their own future actions, as well as to those that are defeated. Unfortunately, we're living in a world where the victors in World War II have broken the Nuremberg Promise. But it's up to us as citizens of democratic societies to try to make our own governments keep that promise. It's a vital symbolic issue, I think. And it's very important, even if no Israeli military or political leader is actually prosecuted or arrested, the idea that they are subject to this legal authority is the beginning of implementing the rule of law, and implementing it in the way that law has to be understood if it is to be respected. That is, it applies equally. It treats equals equally. And what we are now enduring in many phases of international life is to treat equals unequally. We see it very clearly in relation to nuclear weapons, where the geopolitical actors have played an extraordinary mind game with the rest of the world that makes public opinion largely accept the notion that the danger of nuclear weapons arises not from the countries that possess these weapons and threaten to use them, but from the countries that don't have them. It's quite a impressive achievement of mental acrobatics, but it's extremely misleading. There is a line of poetry from the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish that I wanted to leave as one expression of the kind of outlook that seems to me important. And this line is, this is forgetfulness, that you remember the past and not to remember tomorrow in the story. It's the remembering of tomorrow in this unfinished story of the Palestinian struggle that I think we have to try to infuse our own understanding with. Darwish also wrote another line that I wanted to share with you. He said, "Perhaps my imagination is more lucid than my reality." And I think that, again, we have to trust our moral and political imaginations if we are to engage meaningfully and in an effective way in this struggle. And there is one last quotation that seems to me to be very important for those of you, which I hope is all of you, that care about this conflict. And it was a statement made by the very admired Jewish philosopher Abraham Heschel, who said, "Few are guilty, but all are responsible." And I think until we sense this responsibility that enables us to act as, not as subjects, but as citizens, that's what democracy is about. And it is tested in the crucible of difficult conflicts when we're challenged to act as citizens and we're challenged to hold our own governments accountable in relation to law and morality and political wisdom.
Well, that gives us a reminder of what we just talked about with respect to that vote that went down and the president signed off on allotting $225 million more to the $3.1 billion military aid budget to Israel for weapons so that the massacre could continue. Well, I hope that this particular talk by Richard Falk, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council as a special rapporteur on Palestine, gave us some reason to reconsider our thoughts about this so-called peace process. And when it comes up in discussion, it would be helpful to keep this in mind, that the Palestinians basically went from their ancestral land to 45% of it, to 22% of it, and now to 14% of it. And by the way, although this sounds as if he were talking about the subject contemporaneously, this discussion that he just, the speech he just made, was made in 2010, 4 years ago. That's how salient this issue is. I hope that my alarm about the Garner case serves as a reason for people to keep their eyes peeled about this case, I'm very concerned that it's already down the wrong path. And I will be on that because this case should not go that way. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Thank you.